We made it up to slide 9. Let's finish the unit so you can enjoy the test in 2 days. What we're seeing here now is what happens normally in a pigment. A pigment is some substance that is able to absorb photons of some wavelength. All electromagnetic radiation is the same. Remember, it's really the only difference is the wavelength. And pigments are things that absorb photons in the wavelengths within human vision, which is why they look colors to us. But wavelength is part of the wave-like nature of light. There's a duality of light. It has a dual nature, which is beyond the scope of this course, but it's true. Light has both wave-like properties and particle-like properties. You can describe it as a wave, you can describe it as a particle, both at the same time. If you think of light in particulate terms as particles, the individual particles of light, which don't have mass, but they're little particles of energy, light energy, those are called photons. And when a photon encounters an object, like I said in lab a couple weeks ago, there's a few possibilities, right? It can be transmitted. It can go right through that object. It can be reflected, bounced off in some other direction, in other words. And if either of those two things happens, then the photon still exists. It's either going on in straight line still because it went through it, or it's going off in some new direction, but it still exists. The third possibility, though, is that the photon gets absorbed by that substance or object. And if that happens, absorption, then the photon no longer exists. It is destroyed in that process of being absorbed. Now, a photon is a little packet of energy. The photon gets destroyed, but obviously the energy does not, right? Why do I say obviously? Because you can't destroy energy, as we learned in the first law of thermodynamics, right? Energy can't be created or destroyed. And that goes for all energy, including the energy of a photon that itself no longer exists. The energy still exists. Well, the energy gets transferred to the pigment, the thing doing the absorbing of the photon. The photon is no longer there. The energy is now in the pigment. And that transfer of energy to the pigment excites the pigment, or it excites an atom of the pigment, more specifically. Excite here means a specific thing. In this sense, the word excite refers to what happens to an electron of that atom. When an atom gets excited by a photon, that means an electron gets sent up at least one energy level from where it was originally. And we've talked about energy levels a lot, right? The closer the energy level is to the nucleus, the lower the energy. And that's why an increase in energy from the photon allows for an electron to be moved up an energy level, or two, maybe. But at least one if it's excited. That's what it means to be excited. So now the energy that was in the photon is in the excited atom, is the point here. Well, that's a very unstable situation. It's an increase in G, right? Now the atom has a higher G because it's excited, higher free energy. And I told you when we first talked about G that high values of G correspond to instability, which is why systems, if they can, tend to go to a lower G value to become more stable. Like falling off the diving platform, for instance. So this excited atom is highly unstable because the electron would prefer to be at a lower energy level if it can. Now, some electrons in that atom might not be able to go down to a lower energy level because those energy levels are already full, right? That's why you have shells that need to be filled in higher levels when you have extra electrons. But this is an electron that already was at a lower level. So when it gets sent up one level, there is still a spot down there for it. And it wants to go right back down, and will under ordinary circumstances. Well, if that happens, that means the energy is going down, just like the energy goes down during the electron transport, right? Each time it gets transported, it gets a little closer to an electron, to a nucleus. That's why it's a release of energy. So there's a release in energy when the excited electron goes back down. It's not destroyed, though, right? What happens is that a brand new photon, completely different photon from the one that got absorbed originally, gets created to take the energy away from the atom because it can't be destroyed. That's this brand new photon right here on the second yellow squiggle. That is called fluorescence. To fluoresce means to create light in response to being excited and then de-excited. In other words, the pigment is producing its own light. The original light is not there. The light that got absorbed is not there. The new light gets created. That's fluorescence. And that's what pigments do under normal circumstances. And this is why, for instance, if you drive out from the city far enough, you're in true darkness on a highway, the speed limit signs look so bright. That's not just reflection of your headlights. That's fluorescence, fluorescent paint. So your headlights excite the atoms in that paint. The photons of your headlight get destroyed, but that excites the paint, which creates new light that shines into your eyes. That's why they look so bright. Well, that would be a complete waste of sunlight for a photosynthetic organism if fluorescence were allowed to happen. Because the whole idea of capturing sunlight by a photosynthetic organism is to put some of that energy to use to do something, right? Fluorescence doesn't use the energy. It just creates more light and shines it away. So plants wouldn't be able to create any sugars. They wouldn't be able to photosynthesize. They would simply be very bright when they get shown with light. All right? Now, if you have chlorophyll molecules in solution, and chlorophyll is the main photosynthetic pigment, so it's just, this isn't a plant, this is just chlorophyll molecules in water. If you have that such a solution and you shine light on it, it will fluoresce. And why is it fluorescing a different color? Well, if you shine white light on it, the photons that get created are going to be lower energy, right? Because second law tells you some energy has to be lost as heat. Therefore, the new photon has to be a longer wavelength and therefore lower energy than the original photon. And that puts it lower in our visible spectrum, so it changes color. This would not benefit plants at all. But it doesn't happen in plants because compared to just a solution of chlorophyll molecules, plants have a special arrangement of their chlorophyll molecules along with proteins to keep them in a certain arrangement that disallows fluorescence to happen. Slide 10 shows you the arrangement, or a cartoon version. We're looking at a little piece of membrane here, and this is not the plasma membrane, this is the thylakoid membrane, the green membrane making up those thylakoid sacs that we already talked about. And this is a cross-section of this purple thing that looks kind of like a bell pepper. It's a cross-section so that you can see the interior of it, but normally there would be purple things all the way around this blue thing. This overall bell pepper-shaped thing is called a photosystem. And there are two major parts to a photosystem. One is the blue center, which, as you see, is called the reaction center complex. Now, it's a special set of protein complexes, mostly, but also there is a special pair of chlorophyll A molecules in the reaction center complex. The other major part of the photosystem is a collection of the purple things all the way around the reaction center complex, and each of those is called a light harvesting complex. So there are several light harvesting complexes around one reaction center complex. And those two are mostly protein complexes, but the proteins are holding many, many copies of the various kinds of pigments, chlorophyll A, chlorophyll B, and accessory pigments, including carotenoids, all represented by these green things here, keeping them in a special arrangement that disallows fluorescence to happen, which I'll explain hopefully right now. The photon coming in is striking one of these pigment molecules in the photosystem. Now, that doesn't have to happen. A lot of light that hits plants is just wasted as far as photosynthesis is concerned, because that photon does not hit in the right place to actually excite a pigment. It'll just get reflected off or warm up the plant, but it's not doing any good. But still, quadrillions and quadrillions of photons do get lucky enough to hit any one of these pigment molecules. It doesn't have to be this upper left one. It can be any of them. This one happens to be excited, though, as we've talked about already. That's excitation. The first pigment that's directly getting hit by a photon is becoming excited. It does not fluoresce, though. Instead, because of how the neighboring pigment molecules are held in place by the protein complexes in purple, the energy of excitation that the first pigment has as a result of absorbing the photon gets passed on to the next pigment that's held very close to it without producing a photon, without fluorescing. And that transfer of excitation energy from one pigment to the next occurs by a mechanism that's beyond the scope of this course, but I'll tell you that it's called resonance energy transfer. It's enough in this course just to know that what that means is that an already excited pigment in a photosystem can pass that excitation on to the next pigment, which is now excited, and the original pigment molecule is no longer excited, and so on. That's represented by the black arrows. Well, this excitation will bounce around until eventually the special pair of chlorophyll A's that are in the reaction center complex receive the excitation. Okay, that's where we are on the bottom of the blue center. And when that special chlorophyll pair gets excited, it really gets excited. Excitation, as we've already talked about, means that an electron goes up away from the nucleus, right? Well, by really excited, what I mean is that the electron not only gets farther from the nucleus, it actually leaves the entire molecule. That's represented by the E minus, which is the electron in the orange arrow. It actually leaves the chlorophyll, and it ends up being sent to another important component of the reaction center complex, represented by the square here, which is the primary electron acceptor. So chemically, what's happening here? How would you describe what's happening to the primary electron acceptor? It's being reduced. The name itself tells you, right? It's an electron acceptor, so it is becoming reduced. And the special pair of excited chlorophylls is becoming oxidized. It's a redox reaction driven by light originally, by sunlight. All right. Now, think about the redox reactions in the previous unit. We had a lot of them, right? And what they accomplished was oxidation of the fuel to reduce coenzymes, right? NADs or FADs. But when you got that reduced coenzyme, either NADH and H+ or FADH2, that full taxi, the reduced version, was a valuable thing, right? Because it was carrying energy. So what this accomplishes, the photosystem, is storage of energy, well, not just storage, transduction of energy from the form of light into the form of chemically reduced substance, which is carrying some of the energy that the sunlight had. Some of it's wasted as heat, of course. All right. So this primary electron acceptor, when it becomes reduced in this process, it now is storing some energy and can be put to work. That's how a photosystem in general works, and this is just one of trillions of copies of these photosystems. All right, that brings us then to 11, where we can see how these work in the overall process that we identified as part one of photosystem. Part one of photosynthesis. Part one of photosynthesis is called what? The process of photosynthesis has two major parts.
The light-dependent reactions?
Exactly. The light-dependent reactions is what we're looking at in slide 11. And the light-dependent reactions structurally require this setup that we're looking at here in cartoon form. There are two photosystems involved, each one with a purple background. And notice that they are called photosystem 2 on the left and photosystem 1 on the right, which is confusing. Most of us would want to number them the other way, right? Left to right order. Well, this just happened. It would make a lot more sense to call this first one that operates photosystem 1, but they were actually named in the order in which they were discovered. We just happened to discover the second one that works first, so we called that photosystem 1. And the first one to work, we discovered later, we called that photosystem 2. So just be aware of that. Okay? When I'm talking about photosystem 2 in the recording, I'm talking about the one that operates first. And when I'm talking about photosystem 1, it's the second one. So there are trillions and trillions of copies of each of these, but one of each is the bare minimum that you need structurally for the light-dependent reactions to occur, plus linking the two photosystems in between the two in this picture is a complex of proteins and other particles operating as an electron transport chain. It's not identical to the electron transport chain we already studied in cellular respiration, but very close, and it operates the same way. So hopefully you've been wise enough to study that and already have that memorized how that works, because it works the same way here. Right? Electron transport operates by electrons trickling down through it, which releases energy a little bit at a time, allowing for what? What does the transfer of electrons directly accomplish? That's right. The transfer of electrons directly results in the pumping of protons through a membrane. Well, for cellular respiration, that membrane was the inner mitochondrial membrane, right? Because that's where those electron transport chains are housed. Here we're in photosynthesis, so this is the thylakoid membrane we're talking about. But other than that, it's really the same thing happening. And the detail isn't shown here, but because there's no membrane shown here, but members of the chain act as pumps, powered by the release of energy as electrons get transferred. And therefore, that sets up a gradient of protons. And how is the gradient of protons paid off? or how does that pay off? What's the consequence of the gradient of protons?
A lot of reduction?
No.
The other one, isn't it? Oxidation?
No, that's happening in the electron transfer stage.
Yeah.
Those are redox reactions. That's already happened and we pumped some protons. How does that pay off? Is the cell just trying to make a gradient for its own sake?
It was trying to make a gradient for a motor to get ATP pumped.
Right. The payoff of the proton gradient that's created by electron transport is so that when those protons diffuse back to where they got pumped from, through the membrane, in other words, the only place they can do that is through ATP synthase complexes, the little motors, and that causes them to spin, which causes phosphorylation of ADP into ATP. That was true for cellular respiration, where ATP was the goal. It's happening here as well, which is why you see ATP being produced, because of the operation of this electron transport chain. Okay? ATP is not the goal, though. It's an intermediate. All right, but it's produced, and it's valuable stuff. Now, what is part two of photosynthesis? The light-independent reactions, which are made up of the Calvin cycle. Right? The Calvin cycle is just another name for the light-independent reactions. And how did we describe that process in terms of energy and metabolism? What are the two words that apply there? What is it? That's right. The Calvin cycle is anabolic because you're building up a more complex molecule, a sugar, out of less complex CO2. And what's the other word? Endergonic. You should expect an anabolic process to require energy, which is what endergonic means, right? So we've talked about that, but I told you that it's not only endergonic requiring energy, but it requires energy in two forms. What are the two forms? ATP. And what coenzyme? NADPH. Not either one, but both. It needs both of them for the Calvin cycle to occur. Well, ATP is being produced right here as part of the light-dependent reactions. NADPH is also going to be produced, but let me tell you about some other things before we get to that point. Okay, so in cellular respiration, the way that you keep the electron transport happening is how? What's required to keep electron transport happening in cellular respiration? Oxygen, or if you're some other species that doesn't use oxygen, some final electron acceptor, right? You have to have a final electron acceptor or the chain will fill up. Similarly here. Okay, so, it's not oxygen that does the final electron reception. Let's start with photosystem one, the second one to operate. Okay, its light is shining on it. A lucky photon strikes a chlorophyll. It gets excited, and the excitation gets transferred by resonance energy transfer, eventually to the special pair in photosystem one. It loses its electron to the primary electron acceptor. That primary electron acceptor, which is the reduced version of it, quickly then drops that electron it just received off to a second electron transport chain, a shorter one that's after photosystem one. And it doesn't pump any protons to create ATP. Instead, waiting at the end of the chain to pick that electron up is an oxidized version of the coenzyme, in other words, NADP plus, the empty taxi. It will receive the electron and a proton from solution to become, or two electrons and two protons, I'm sorry, to become NADPH, NH plus. Okay? So that fills a taxi. That's how the other energetic requirement of part two, Calvin cycle, gets created. So you make ATP and NADPH. Yeah.
So the thing that puts the electrons on the NADP plus and the proton from the hydrogen would be NADP plus reductase?
Well, that's just the enzyme that allows this to happen. The reductase, yeah, speeds it up and allows it to happen. It basically hands the electrons and protons off to the NADP plus to make it into NADPH. Now, when the special pair of chlorophylls loses the electron, that is not only unstable, that is much more unstable than a normally excited one out in the light harvesting complexes is. In other words, it totally lost this electron. Well, it wants an electron back very badly. It doesn't care what electron it is because all electrons are the same. The one it lost is going to be sent to the taxi, so it's not coming back. But it quickly gets replaced with an electron that started out in photosystem 2 and went down the chain between the two photosystems. You see that? So instead of oxygen taking electrons at the end of this chain, the chlorophyll pair that lost an electron will take the electron from that first chain. Okay, is that all clear? Okay, now let's go back in time to the first photosystem, which is photosystem 2. It's also becoming excited by light. So there's resonance energy transfer, sending that excitation eventually to its special pair. And that special pair, of course, will lose the electron, and that's the electron that then goes down the electron transport chain and replaces the electron lost from photosystem 1. Okay? That's also, for this special pair on photosystem 2, a very unstable situation. It really wants an electron, but there's no electron transport chain feeding it. So it's a different source of electrons that are going to replace the ones lost from photosystem 2. And the source for that is hydrogen. Hydrogen atoms from water that is an input into not only photosynthesis, but specifically an input into the light-dependent reactions. Remember we talked about material inputs? The material inputs for the light-dependent reactions are water and empty taxis, NADP+, and lower energy coenzymes, ADP and inorganic phosphate. Well, the ADP gets turned into ATP. The NADP+ turns into NADPH. And the water turns into oxygen, and then that yields hydrogen atoms to work with. So the water for photosynthesis isn't about keeping the plant turgid osmotically. That's another use of water. The water for photosynthesis serves as a source for hydrogens as electrons and protons. Just like the hydrogens of fuel in the previous chapter from glucose was a source of electrons and protons that got used for energetic purposes, got carried by taxis. Same thing happening here. You see that? So there's a special enzyme that splits water enzymatically into oxygen and hydrogen. That's why the output, material output of the light-dependent reactions is oxygen. It's a byproduct of photosynthesis. not because it's trying to produce oxygen, it's just that's what's left over when you take the hydrogens from water. The hydrogens then become electrons and protons separately. The protons aren't really dealt with here, but they're there. The protons get pumped, right? The electrons get transported. And so that's what replaces the electrons lost when this first photosystem 2, gets excited. That comes from hydrogen. Those electrons do. And so eventually when you have all of this happening, the electrons and protons that end up in NADPH also came from water. They just went through some steps before they got there. Is that all clear? Exactly. Exactly. Because if you made only ATP or you made only NADPH, you couldn't do part two. Part two needs both. Any questions on this, the light-dependent reactions? Well, slide 12 is just a cartoon analogy of this. So the guy with the hammer originally is like the photon of light. That provides the energy, lifts that electron up, that can then roll down this electron transport chain, turning the mill, which is ATP synthase, really, to produce ATP. Another light then re-excites this electron, and that gets sent down a smaller chain to reduce NADP plus into NADPH. Both energy-carrying molecules are required for the next step, for the next part. Now, in 13, this is basically the same figure that we looked at two slides ago, but some of it is dimmed out, notice. What we already studied in slide 11 was called non-cyclic electron flow. Non-cyclic because it was a one-way travel of the electrons through the first chain, then through the second chain, ending up in NADPH. It wasn't a cycle. Okay? Well, the same set of photosystems and electron transport chains can operate either for non-cyclic electron flow, which we already looked at, or what's shown here, which is called cyclic electron flow. So don't think that there's special arrangements of photosystems that do this and special arrangements of photosystems that do non-cyclic. Any arrangement of photosystems with electron transport chains can do either one of these, as whichever one is better for the plant or photosynthetic organism. But why it's called cyclic electron flow is that when the electron goes down the first chain to replace photosystem 1's electron that got lost, the electron that gets excited from photosystem 1, instead of going down that second chain, gets sent back to the first chain. That's why it's cyclic. Electrons keep going through the chain over and over. And the reason they're able to do that is because they keep getting excited by photons here. Okay? So in darkness, this wouldn't happen. It would shut down. But as long as the light is shining, the electrons will cycle back through the first chain. And what does the first chain accomplish? Production of ATP. So if a set of photosystems and electron transport chains are operating this way for cyclic electron flow, then that means the only energy-carrying molecules they're producing are ATP. No NADPH gets created. Well, I've already told you several times that part two, the Calvin cycle, requires both ATP and NADPH, so why would a plant ever do this? The answer is that although it does need, but the Calvin cycle does need both ATP and NADPH, it doesn't need them in a one-to-one ratio. It doesn't need equal amounts of both. It needs more ATP than it needs NADPH. So if NADPH is already built up, which is basically the other way of saying you don't have enough ATP, you have enough NADPH, but you don't have enough ATP, then it will switch over to operating via cyclic electron flow so that it makes only ATP for a while. Because if you only did non-cyclic electron flow, producing both in equal amounts, that would be sending an equal amount of ATP and NADPH to the Calvin cycle, but it wouldn't be using them in those equal amounts. So you can look at that as look at that problem in two different ways. It's the same thing. You can think of it as either producing too much NADPH or not enough ATP, right? Because you have to make more you have to use a different ratio of ATP to NADPH. So it'll switch to this. How does it know how to switch? Well, this is just like what happens if you don't have oxygen, right? If you don't have oxygen for cellular respiration, the taxis can't dump anywhere, right? Similarly, if you already have all of your taxis and your NADP taxis in reduced form, there aren't any empty ones available to pick up in the second electron transport chain. If all of your NADP taxis are reduced already, they can't allow the second chain to operate. So the only place the electrons can go is back through the first chain. It will automatically do that, simply for that reason. Do you see that? And therefore, only ATP will be produced for a while. Now, eventually, part two, which is operating using these things, will eventually start using NADPH enough to empty enough taxis so that they will be available to pick up the electrons on the second chain, and it will automatically switch back to non-cyclic electron flow. So by switching back and forth, it will always be making exactly the right ratio of ATP to NADPH to meet the demands of part two, the light independent reactions. It's just a feedback mechanism. In 14, we're comparing the electron transport that occurs in cellular respiration to the electron transport that occurs between the two photosystems in photosynthesis. And this cartoon on the bottom really can represent either one of the processes because they're really essentially the same. It's just that depending on which process you're talking about, the spaces and the membrane get named different things. So if it's cellular respiration you're talking about, then the membrane that embeds the chain is the inner mitochondrial membrane. If it's photosynthesis, then it's the thylakoid membrane. If the process you're talking about is cellular respiration, then the pumping of protons occurs from the matrix, the mitochondrial matrix, through the inner mitochondrial membrane to the intermembrane space. And protons diffuse through ATP synthase back into the matrix. If it's a chloroplast you're talking about, photosynthesis, then it's just a different name for the chambers. The protons get pumped from the stroma through the thylakoid membrane into the thylakoid space, the interior of the coins, and then these protons diffuse back through ATP synthases to get back into the stroma. And that's what produces the ATP. Same process. The chains are molecularly a little bit different, but not functionally. Fifteen shows you more of an anatomical diagram of the light-dependent reactions. So here we have one set of photosystems, photosystem 2, photosystem 1, electron transport chain between them, and then a shorter electron transport chain after photosystem 1, all embedded in the thylakoid membrane, and there are millions and millions of other exact copies of this whole system. But we're just looking at one of them. Photons come along and excite both photosystems. They lose electrons. Well, the electron for photosystem 1 gets replaced by the one that comes from photosystem 2. The electron that's lost from photosystem 2 gets replaced from water being split. which is why oxygen is produced. Okay. And if what we're looking at here is non-cyclic electron flow, so both energetic molecules are produced, meaning ATP, because those protons that get pumped diffuse back out into the stroma through ATP synthase molecules, and NAD+ gets reduced into NADPH and H+. Where do the hydrogens come from for NADP+? Water, originally, yes. Whereas in cellular respiration, the hydrogens that are in NADH come from where? Glucose, or whatever fuel you're burning. All right, good. So notice that all of this stuff is produced, or both of these energetic molecules, NADPH and ATP, are produced in the stroma, not inside the thylakoid space, in the stroma, which is nice because that's where the Calvin cycle occurs, and the Calvin cycle is what requires both of those energy-carrying molecules. So now we're ready for the Calvin cycle, or part two of photosynthesis. Slide 16 shows this, Calvin cycle, also called the light-independent reactions. And as the name indicates, it's not only a pathway, but it's a cyclic arrangement. It's so the end of the pathway feeds the beginning of the pathway, just like the other cycle we looked at, which was what? Citric acid cycle, or tricarboxylic acid cycle, or Krebs cycle, all the same thing in cellular respiration. This is the Calvin cycle. And the goal here, unlike the citric acid cycle, the goal is not to produce ATP. The goal is to produce organic compounds. Part two of photosynthesis, the light-independent reactions, has material inputs. Two material inputs are the energy-carrying molecules. ATP is an input, NADPH is an input. The other material input, importantly, is carbon dioxide, inorganic form of carbon. Because what's accomplished by the Calvin cycle that's so important chemically? Not decarboxylation. Well, glucose can get formed, yes, but what's really chemically important about this? You're starting with CO2, you're ending up with a carbohydrate. We can't do that. We consumers cannot do that. What is this important process? Exactly. Carbon fixation is what's happening. Carbon fixation is the incorporation of carbon from an inorganic source into an organic compound. The organic compound that gets created at the bottom of this cycle, notice, is G3P, not glucose, actually. G3P, which is short for glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, an important intermediate in glycolysis, if you go back and look at the details of glycolysis. It's a 3-carbon sugar, not a 6-carbon sugar. So that's really the direct output of photosynthesis. But once you have G3Ps, they can be combined to make glucose. That's really after photosynthesis, really.
Isn't it like 2/2 of it?
It's like 1/2 of it, but you're making them over and over. So you can combine two of them into a 6-carbon sugar.
Every time it runs twice, you get glucose.
You can, yes. But it's not only glucose for its own sake. I think I was mentioning this before, but plants don't use photosynthesis just to produce fuels. They do feed themselves. They produce fuel, but there's much more you can do with an organic compound than use it to burn as fuel. You can rearrange it into all kinds of other organic compounds that make the stuff of your body. Okay? So you can make it into other things besides carbohydrates. You can make it into protein, amino acids for proteins, and so on. Okay, so that's a material output, carbohydrate. But we've already discussed that is an endergonic process, anabolic and endergonic, which explains why in two different places here you have ATP being spent, not created, like it was in the citric acid cycle, but spent. Six ATPs here, three ATPs here. These are per turn. And so that's nine total ATPs, but you also need energy in the form of NADPH, and notice that it's six required. Well, notice that these aren't, that's not a one-to-one ratio like I was talking about. Nine ATPs to six NADPHs. That's why the photosystems need to switch back and forth between cyclic electron flow and non-cyclic, so that it's always delivering exactly the right ratio for the Calvin cycle. Now, just like the citric acid cycle at the start-finish line at the top of the cycle had something put into it, remember that was the acetyl group dropped off by the coenzyme A from part one of cellular respiration. Here you have CO2 coming in at the start-finish line. That's the carbon source, inorganic carbon in the form of CO2. Each CO2, of course, contains one carbon. That's why it's represented just by a single gray sphere. So, at the top, the start-finish line here, is where the last intermediate accepts CO2. And this last intermediate, notice, is called ribulose bisphosphate. Bisphosphate just refers to the fact that it's doubly phosphorylated. There's two phosphates on it. But ribulose is a 5-carbon sugar. And when that 5-carbon sugar accepts another carbon from CO2, it becomes a 6-carbon intermediate that is so short-lived that it's not even given a name here. It's produced, but it immediately then splits into 2 3-carbon compounds for the rest of the cycle. Okay? Now, you shouldn't be surprised that this step of incorporating CO2 into this carbon skeleton that's going to go from 5 to 6 requires an enzyme. Every individual reaction essentially requires an enzyme in biology. And the enzyme here, shown in the purple box, is called Rubisco for short. Now, Rubisco is an acronym, really, and I prefer to write it as capital R U capital B I S capital C capital O.
That's an acronym.
Yes, it's an acronym, which means it stands for a phrase, right? The phrase is ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase oxygenase.
I'm glad it's a acronym.
Well, that's why we call it Rubisco, but it's important to consider what this means. So let's write it out. Okay, importantly, Rubisco, ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase oxygenase, is an enzyme. You can tell that by its full name. Rubisco doesn't tell you that, but the full name tells you it's an enzyme, right? A-S-E ending. Importantly, though, Rubisco is not ribulose bisphosphate. Ribulose bisphosphate is in the name of the enzyme, but the enzyme is not ribulose bisphosphate. Ribulose bisphosphate is one of the substrates. The other substrate is carbon dioxide coming in. Another thing you can tell by this whole name is that not only is it an enzyme, it's actually two enzymes in one. It's an enzyme that acts as a carboxylase, or can act as a carboxylase, but it can also act as an oxygenase. A carboxylase, it's called a carboxylase because it's able to use CO2, which is essentially a carboxyl group, as a substrate. It can incorporate carbon dioxide, synthesize it with ribulose bisphosphate, the other substrate. And that's what the plant wants to happen. Because the goal of this cycle is to produce the sugar. And you can't produce the sugar unless you turn a 5-carbon compound into a 6-carbon compound. You're only going to be able to do that is if what you add to ribulose bisphosphate contains carbon, CO2. Okay, so that's what it wants to operate as, a carboxylase. But it also just chemically happens to be able to operate as an oxygenase as well. An oxygenase, if it operates as an oxygenase, then instead of CO2 being added to ribulose bisphosphate, oxygen gets added, which of course doesn't have any carbon. And that's why the plant does not want that to happen. But not only is it chemically possible for Rubisco to operate either way, but it's actually more likely for Rubisco to operate as an oxygenase because it has a higher affinity for oxygen than it does for CO2. If that happens, if oxygen gets incorporated instead of CO2, then the plant not only can't produce any sugar for that round of the cycle, which is bad enough, but it also produces something other than this short-lived intermediate, which it's supposed to make, and that something else needs to be dealt with chemically to get it processed it back into ribulose bisphosphate so you can continue on the correct path. And that takes time and energy. So it's doubly bad for the plant because you're not producing the goal molecule and you're also having to spend energy to undo the problem of oxygen coming in instead of CO2. Anyway, that's why both of those A's words are in there, carboxylase and oxygenase. If it does happen that oxygen wins out, which is often in a lot of plants, then instead of the Kelvin cycle occurring normally, what we have is a process called photorespiration. Called photorespiration. They use respiration by analogy because it's swapping oxygen for CO2, really. But it's not really that it's respiration. This photorespiration, though, is a wasteful thing that happens in plants. So it cuts into their energy budget. Part of the photons that get absorbed end up being wasted because of photorespiration. Well, I have a couple slides to show you that some plants have, some groups of plants have evolved ways to deal with that problem of photorespiration. A lot of plants don't have a mechanism in place, so they just have to live with the waste, with the photorespiration occurring, so they're not as efficient in their production of sugar via photosynthesis as other plants. Those are called C3 plants, the normal ones. All right? Oh, I shouldn't go to 17 yet because I haven't quite finished 16. The thing I didn't mention about this is that the overall Calvin cycle occurs in three phases that are labeled here. Phase 1, phase 2, phase 3 are labeled. The first phase is carbon fixation. This is where the carbon fixation occurs because as soon as the carbon from CO2 gets added to ribulose bisphosphate, that carbon is now part of an organic compound. That's why it's carbon fixation. Okay, so normally in a C3 plant, carbon fixation occurs right here in the Calvin cycle. The second phase is reduction, but it's not reduction of a taxi, it's oxidation of a taxi so that the intermediates in the cycle can be reduced. That gives them energy so that they can then continue on. All right? And then the third phase is regeneration of the CO2 acceptor. Well, the CO2 acceptor is ribulose bisphosphate. That's what RUBP is short for. RUBP is ribulose bisphosphate. Rubisco is the enzyme, ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase oxygenase, that accepts ribulose bisphosphate and carbon dioxide, hopefully. As those are the three phases. All of that happens in a C3 plant, as described. Now let's go to 17 and talk about some plants that have gotten around this problem of photorespiration. First up in 17 is what we call a C4 plant. In a C4 plant, well, In both types of plants we're going to talk about that have solved this problem, what they have done evolutionarily is separate carbon fixation from the Calvin cycle. And there's two ways that that can happen. One way is to spatially separate it, meaning have carbon fixation and the Calvin cycle happen in two different spaces, specifically two different types of cell. Think back to when we looked at the leaf anatomy. That was for a normal C3 plant. The sandwich I was talking about, that arrangement between the pieces of bread, the epidermal layers, was a layer of cells that specialize in photosynthesis that are rich in chloroplasts. And those were called mesophyll cells. We see one right here. But a C3 plant has just those mesophyll cells. A C4 plant, in addition to mesophyll cells, has bundle sheath cells that are deeper in the interior, away from the surface, either surface of the leaf. Okay? Now let's look at a close-up of each of these two cells. The mesophyll cell is closer to the air, closer to the surface of the leaf, which is where the oxygen and carbon dioxide both are, right? Well, in a C4 plant, you don't go directly to the Calvin cycle. You have this other cycle operating with a special enzyme called PEP carboxylase. PEP stands for phosphoenolpyruvate, but you don't have to remember that. It's just an acronym, though. It's a carboxylase only. Unlike Rubisco, it is not an oxygenase. So the only thing that will work with this is what the plant wants to come in, which is CO2. That's where the carbon fixation takes place, because the CO2 is now getting fixed into an intermediate of this cycle, before the Calvin cycle, in a different cell, spatial separation. When it goes around the cycle, though, one of the intermediates, malate, which is a four-carbon compound, that's why they're called C4 plants, gets transferred through plasmodesmata into this deeper cell, the bundle sheath cell. It's deeper in the interior, and therefore it's not right by the atmosphere where the O2 is. Well, this is where the Calvin cycle takes place, which would normally be interfered with by oxygen, but because it's away from the environment, the atmosphere, CO2 wins out. There's no oxygen to interfere this deep in the leaf. And therefore, that's a hell of a lot more efficient. It ends up making a lot more sugar for the given amount of light that shines on it and the given amount of CO2 that comes in. But do you see that this is a spatial separation, a separation in space between carbon fixation and the Calvin cycle? Okay, well, that's one tactic. That's what one group of plants ended up doing by natural selection. Another group of plants solved it a different way. This is slide 18. Well, we have C4 plants on the left. We've already talked about that in the previous slide. The other way of solving the problem is, instead of separating the processes spatially into two different chambers, you can solve it by separating the processes temporally, in time, in other words. Do them at different times, rather than in different spaces. And the type of plants that have evolved this mechanism are abbreviated as CAM plants. That's another acronym. It stands for crassulation acid metabolism. Now, this weird word, crassulation, just happens to be the group of plants in which we first discovered this. They're not the only plants that can do it, but that's why we use that as the name. Crassulation acid metabolism is CAM. A CAM plant does pretty much the same thing that a C4 does, except instead of having those two things happen in two different cells, they happen day and night instead. Now, CAM plants tend to grow in places that are pretty hot during the day. a lot of sunlight. And when you have a lot of sunlight and high temperatures, you're more likely to lose water. So this is what I'm about to describe as far as efficiency with respect to photorespiration is advantageous doubly for a CAM plant, because if they remain with their stomata open during the day, that will allow CO2 to come in, which normal plants have to have because they need CO2 for photosynthesis. But it also allows water to escape. And if it's really hot out, the plant can become dehydrated if it has open stomata. Well, a CAM plant closes down during the day. It has its stomata closed. And that has the added benefit of allowing a lot less evaporation and therefore dehydration. But during the day, the stomata are closed, okay? At night, they're opened up. Now, there's no light at night, of course, right? So the light-dependent reactions are not happening at night. But what happens at night is that when the stomata are opened up, CO2 can come in and become fixed into this first cycle. That's where carbon fixation is occurring. And I shouldn't say where, it's when, right? Because in this plant, they're separating the processes temporally. So at night, carbon fixation occurs, and that produces a bunch of organic acids. That's why this is called acid metabolism. Okay? The organic acids are really just a way of temporarily storing the CO2 that used to be just pure CO2. It's incorporating the CO2 into organic acids that build up overnight. Then close down the stomata when the sun comes out, saves water. You're not letting any more CO2 in, but that's no problem because all these organic acids that build up overnight can now be broken down to yield the CO2 again, which then feeds the Calvin cycle along with the ATP and NADPH that's coming from the light-dependent reactions now that it's daytime. And so that's when the sugars get produced. And by doing that, it also avoids interference with O2. So it also solves the problem of photorespiration. Two different tactics to solve the problem. Slide 19 is the final slide, and it is just a summary. So there's no new information here, but it's useful to go through this again. And since this is a process, this is a great example of something that you should be able to do as a study tactic on your own, out loud, without looking at anything, to determine whether or not you're ready for this exam. Photosynthesis occurs entirely in a eukaryote within the chloroplast, not partially in the cytosol, and consists of two parts, the light-dependent reactions first, and the light-independent reactions, or Calvin cycle, second. The material inputs into the light-dependent reaction are water, which serves as a source of protons and electrons from hydrogen, oxidized coenzyme in the form of NADP+, lower energy nucleotides in the form of ADP plus inorganic phosphate. Those are the inputs materially. The non-material input, of course, is the energy from sunlight in the form of photons. Because it'll shut down, as the name implies, the light-independent reactions won't happen without a steady stream of light. Okay, so the light provides the energy. It provides the energy by exciting pigment molecules in the thylakoid membranes in the form of photosystems. By resonance energy transfer, those electrons in the photosystems get transferred through electron transport chains to pump protons, creating a gradient that pays off in the form of phosphorylated ADP, in other words, ATP, when the ATP synthase molecules spin. Okay, that's one output of the light-independent reactions, ATP. At the second electron transport chain, after photosystem 1, the electrons end up, and protons, end up getting picked up by NADP plus, reducing it into NADPH. That's the second material output. And the other material output is what's left over from water after you take away the hydrogens. That's why oxygen comes out. Okay, so what's accomplished here is the transduction of energy in the form of light into chemical energy in the form of ATP and NADPH. Both of the energy requirements for the second part of photosynthesis, which is the citric acid, the Calvin cycle, that is the part of photosynthesis that actually accomplishes carbon fixation, incorporation of carbon from an inorganic form, CO2, into an organic compound, which are directly at first three carbon sugars, but they can be made into other sugars and other compounds. That's an expensive process, which is why ATP and NADPH are both inputs into the Calvin cycle. The other input, of course, is CO2 itself. The outputs are the sugar, which is the goal, and then what's left of the energy-carrying molecules. ADP gets turned into ADP, an inorganic phosphate. NADPH gets turned into NADP+. They both drive back to the light-independent reactions to get recharged. And so as long as the light keeps shining, and as long as you have CO2 available, this will continue to happen. And the plant will not only feed itself, it will form organic compounds for use for whatever. Just like we don't use all of our food for fuel, we use it for raw materials to build things in our body. Same thing in a photosynthetic organism. But continue to appreciate the reciprocal relationship between this and last chapter, complete oxidation of glucose. They're not actually reverses of each other. They happen in different paths, but the summary reactions are opposite. All right. I'll see you in the laboratory. Don't forget a Scantron.